today how white nationalist groups that were allowed to operate on Facebook launched a campaign of hate against Guardian journalist Julia Carey Wong. Before we start this episode, I just want to warn you that it does begin with a distressing personal account.
I went home last November to visit my family for Thanksgiving. My grandmother was 105 years old, and she was starting to really decline in her health. We knew that it was the last Thanksgiving that we were going to have with her. And my family always cooks this kind of traditional Chinese-American stuffing. I and my sister-in-law both picked the sausage out of the sticky rice because we don't eat sausage. I just have this vivid memory of her kind of, you know, reaching across to take the sausage herself and saying, well, you don't know how to live. And thinking to myself that nobody could ever say of her that she didn't know how to live. The other really strong memories that I have from that Thanksgiving, though, a moment when I had kind of gone into the kitchen, my phone was in there and I looked down on it and I had a new email. And I opened it up and it was a horrifying, racist, slur-filled rape threat. I don't remember precisely what, but I do remember that there was expressing a desire not just to rape me, but also I think to cut me up into pieces and kill me. And I remember just kind of like dropping my phone and kind of just saying, you know, looking away, like realizing that I just had to not say anything, that I had to pretend that nothing had happened because this was the last Thanksgiving that we were going to spend with my papa, my grandmother, and I didn't want us to spend it talking about the Nazis that at the time were trying to scare me.
It's really harrowing to hear about that message that my colleague Julia Carey Wong was forced to read during a family dinner, and even more distressing when you find out that it was one of dozens of hateful messages sent to her. It happened after Julia reported on her attempt to get white nationalist organisations removed from Facebook. What happened next was weeks of racist and sexist harassment by supporters of those groups. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, becoming the target of a campaign of hate. Julia, this started for you in late 2019 when, as a tech reporter, you were covering the controversy around the launch of Facebook News and in particular the decision to include the highly controversial Breitbart News as a trusted source. That led you on to another story, didn't it?
Being a tech reporter, I guess, in this day and age, it has kind of come to include this intersection with extremism and hate. In the context of that, I decided to take a look at how Facebook was doing when it came to keeping explicit and openly white nationalist groups off of its platform. With Facebook, there's always a huge gap between what the stated policy is and what the actual reality is when it comes to them actually putting in the resources to police their own platforms. So I decided to just go take a look and see what was out there. Among the groups that I found was Red Ice TV, which is a really virulently hateful neo-Nazi organization. VDare, which is one of kind of the oldest and kind of more established, vehemently anti-immigrant organizations. These were just some of the groups that were still existing on the platform in November 2019, you know, which is 2.5 years after, you know, we had seen killing by white nationalists in Charlottesville, more than 6 months after Facebook had said that they had banned white nationalism, that this stuff was still on their platform.
I mean, that's pretty shocking. What happened when you alerted Facebook to it?
What happened when I alerted Facebook to it was what normally happens when I have alerted Facebook to these things in the past, which is that they did nothing. They will tend to respond by saying, you know, yes, that like we do have a policy against white nationalism, but then they will start to argue around the edges and simply say, you know, our policies don't apply here. We published our articles a couple of days later. I think maybe 5 or 6 days after publication, they did come back to me and say that they had decided that Red Ice TV, that they were going to ban that group. They did not take the same action against VDare. VDare remained on the platform until actually this May, when they kicked them off for violating a completely different policy. And other groups, such as Holocaust denial groups that I had also flagged to them, were using the platform. They just said explicitly, actually, that they don't have any policy against Holocaust denial.
I mean, you said that Facebook reacted in the way that they'd reacted before. What had happened before?
So this is this is not the first time that I've gone to Facebook with information about far-right extremist hate groups using their platform to organize. It's actually the third time, you know, just in 3 years that I've done this. It's kind of turned into an annual tradition, and one that I wish I didn't have to do. In 2017, I started working on a story about what I was observing, which was that there were a lot of extremist groups and a lot of extremist organizations were popping up in the real world that had their roots in organizing on Facebook. This is not people that are kind of hiding themselves as like a men's club. This was people that were using the language of, you know, Jim Crow era hate groups that were existing openly on the platform. And when I took that to Facebook, you know, they had no problem with, I think, anything more than a couple. I think that they took down the ones that actually had KKK in the name. But many of the most dangerous groups that would, a couple weeks later, become kind of national and international news because of their involvement in the Charlottesville Unite the Right protest that resulted in the death of Heather Heyer, many of those organizations, Facebook looked at them and said, yeah, we have no problem with them using our platform. You know, they're not using the platform because they want to share pictures of their kids. Extremist groups use Facebook because they want to recruit new members, they want to organize offline events, and they want to spread their propaganda either, you know, by, you know, finding a new audience or by harassing and going after the people that they hate. So there's no kind of neutral, positive use of Facebook as a tool by hate groups. That's not what they're there for.
And that was Facebook. But of course, the next thing that happened was that white nationalist groups using the platform began to target you. Tell me how they responded.
They responded with a lot of anger and, I guess not surprisingly, a lot of hate. We publish an article that points out that, you know, these groups are on Facebook against Facebook's stated rules, the perception, right, is that, you know, I'm saying that these groups should come off of Facebook. And when it comes to white nationalist hate groups, yes, I think that those groups should come off Facebook. With the November story, what was kind of surprising was that Breitbart, which I had also discussed in my article, decided to assign a reporter to write about me and started sending emails to me, calling me, emailing my editor, trying to assert that I am the real racist. And at the same time, the white nationalist groups started to attack me on social media and started to spread the word that I was this evil leftist mainstream reporter that was trying to censor them, that was trying to get them kicked off the internet. I think that they kind of worked in tandem, and it just kind of unleashed this massive harassment campaign that was quite ugly and difficult, you know, just tons and tons and tons of, you know, just websites, blogs, kind of pseudo publications that I don't really want to name because I don't want to send people to their websites. But they started writing articles about me, kind of dissecting my particular racial background, which is half Chinese and half Jewish. And that, of course, is something that is just disgusting and appalling to white nationalists and to racists. I think we all try to, or I try to pretend like this stuff doesn't bother me. You know, I'm a reporter. I went looking at this stuff. But at the same time, you know, it is deeply kind of disturbing to look at an article written on some website that talks about me by my full name, includes a picture of me, and then says, you know, that I I am the result of a racial Molotov cocktail that, you know, it's so frightening because, you know, that I unite the cunning of the Jew and the meticulous mathematical mind of a chink. The creativity that these people have when it comes to just saying the most hateful and disgusting things about race and gender is it's just this strange thing to know that I exist, that my family exists, that we have what I think of as a very beautiful mixed family with, you know, different heritages. And that is something that I've always been proud of because I love my family and I love our story and the fact that my parent got together at a time when interracial marriage was not that common and that, you know, my grandparents became friends. And, you know, there's all this stuff that to me is very beautiful about my family. And so to have that be twisted into something that is so disgusting and ugly to other people and to have that part of me be the subject of somebody's disgust, not anything that I've done as an actual, you know, actor, as an agent, things that I've done in my life. You know, it's just difficult to kind of be face to face with that just kind of base disgust with my own existence.
I mean, part of me wants to say to you, don't listen to a word of this. You know, that kind of beautiful image of you have of your family life is what the vast majority of the people in the world would see. And these are disgusting people on the extreme. On the other hand, you know, I've never had even 1/100th of what you're describing. And I've sat in my lounge and cried my eyes out literally about streams of abuse online. It is very, very difficult for you to deal with. And it must have been incredibly scary as well.
This is just something that I'm continuing to kind of deal with as a reporter. You know, I used to report on police. I used to report on protests and I would go out and the threat that I would be aware of was something that was physical. And that was one kind of threat. And this other type of threat has just been, it's just difficult to deal with because it is predominantly just a mental thing, right? Like this is a tactic to get people to stop reporting on them. It's a tactic to get people to stop trying to stop them from gaining more supporters.
This stream of hate came to you through all sorts of different platforms, but it began because of your reporting on how some of these groups were not being banned from Facebook. Did you go to Facebook? Did you tell them that groups still operating on their site were targeting you like this?
It's interesting because with other platforms, there have been instances where staff have noticed a harassment campaign and have actually reached out proactively. Facebook has never done that with me. I don't really want or need Facebook to deal with my personal situation. So I'm not sure what I would even want Facebook to do. What I mean, besides what these articles are about, which is that I want Facebook to actually enforce its policies against white nationalism on its platform. I want Facebook to stop providing its tools to hateful extremists.
And even if you didn't go to them on a personal level, you had been going to them about what you found in November. They acted in one case, but not others. Did anything further happen beyond that?
No. I mean, no. So even just in the past couple of months, a new explicitly violent far-right movement arose on Facebook called the Boogaloo Group. And despite being alerted over and over again throughout the spring, Facebook did nothing until after there had been multiple criminal violent acts linked to the group. And again, Facebook finally took action on those groups, but only after somebody had died.
Coming up, the pressure mounts on Facebook as a campaign to stop hate for profit is noticed by the world's biggest advertisers. Since you and others began piling pressure onto Facebook about some of these groups, a lot has happened to the social media giant. We've, of course, had a pandemic. and the Black Lives Matter protests that began in the wake of George Floyd's death. Facebook didn't act against Donald Trump's post, the one where he wrote, "Once the looting starts, the shooting starts." And that became a flashpoint around failure by the platform to tackle hate. At one point, their staff staged a virtual walkout. We covered this period with our UK technology editor, Alex Hearn. But really, it feels like the turning point for Facebook seems to have come when advertisers started to pull out. Tell me how that took shape.
The controversy over the looting, shooting threat that Trump posted, it seems that that helped to coalesce this coalition of organizations that came together to say, all right, you know, enough is enough. We need to go after Facebook's bottom line. Groups, Color of Change, the NAACP, the Anti-Defamation League, some other organizations, they came together, they called this boycott, and they were asking advertisers to stop, you know, running ads on Facebook's platform for the month of July. It started to gather steam. It was getting a lot of support from the outdoors industry. And then it was a Friday just at the end of June, was kind of first thing in the morning on that Friday, Unilever, which is one of the largest consumer brands kind of holding companies in the world, and I think one of the largest advertisers in the world, they announced that they were pulling all of their advertisements from Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and not just for a month, but actually for 6 months. So shortly after that announcement, you know, all of the reporters on the Facebook beat got an email from Facebook saying, just wanted to let you know that literally in 12 minutes from now, Mark Zuckerberg will be going live on Facebook with an update.
12-minute warning. Did you get that email?
I did. I was like, oh, wow. Much notice. this doesn't seem like it was hastily thrown together in any way.
I know. I've got this kind of image in my mind of just panic in Facebook's what I assume are incredibly shiny headquarters in Silicon Valley, running around going,
yeah,
Unilever have gone. What can we do? So come on, you must have sat down at your computer and watched what happened.
Sadly, I think that probably the mental images that everybody was running around in their own homes, because we're still under lockdown here. Mark Zuckerberg appeared on this video stream. I have to be honest, I mean, he's not a comfortable public speaker, but he seemed particularly uncomfortable and kind of on the defensive.
If we determine the content may lead to violence or deprive people of their right to vote, we're going to take that content down, no matter who says it. We're going to add a prompt.
He announced some very minor tweaks to some of Facebook's policies, which seemed, you know, they seemed designed to appease certain criticisms, but they were quite narrow. It didn't really work. I think it was just a few hours after Zuckerberg's appearance that Coca-Cola, another massive advertiser, of course, also pulled out and joined the boycott. A few days later, we saw kind of the debut of another kind of aggressive move in this PR campaign. Nick Clegg, who is now Facebook's top executive for policy and communications.
And formerly our deputy prime minister, of course.
Of course. He published an op-ed in a trade publication for the advertising industry where he was making the case that actually Facebook is against hate, and kind of attempting to recast our kind of general consideration of Facebook to say, let's stop focusing so much on what's bad and start really calculating and paying attention to all of the good things that happen on Facebook, which to me kind of suggests that they have come up with some kind of moral calculus and moral algorithm, and that on balance, Facebook is coming out on top.
How did you imagine that working?
when I was reading the Clegg's op-ed, you know, I just have this mental image of him, you know, sitting down with his balance sheet at the end of the quarter and saying, well, I see that in the red, we have this murder of a security officer who allegedly was carried out by extremists who met and coordinated their attack on Facebook. Oh, but look, here's one for the black. An adorable grandmother just liked a photo posted by her grandson who lives 500 miles away. I'm sort of joking, but there is a very serious side to this. The most kind of notable being that Facebook has actually been implicated by the United Nations for playing a role in the genocide of the Rohingya in Myanmar.
The site has been used to incite violence against Rohingya refugees living in the country's Rakhine state. Rohingyas are a Muslim minority group. Myanmar's Buddhist-led military launched a brutal crackdown on the group last summer, forcing around 700,000 Rohingyas to flee their homes.
When Facebook is trying to deal with this blow to its reputation, it's not just the advertisers themselves. It's some of the groups you mentioned, the NGOs, who are calling on advertisers to boycott the platform. You know, groups like Colour of Change. And they actually have had a meeting with CEO Mark Zuckerberg, haven't they? How did that go?
Yes. So they had a meeting with Zuckerberg. You know, the number one word that the leaders who were part of that meeting kept repeating after it was just disappointing. These groups have been talking and talking and talking and talking with Facebook. Facebook keeps saying, well, let's keep having a dialogue. Let's keep having a dialogue. And at this point, they seem pretty fed up and kind of just over the idea that dialogue is gonna move the needle, because they've been in dialogue for several years now.
It seems to me that there may be many reasons why Facebook don't act more on this. I'm just interested in whether, in their minds, it's a practical thing that they think it's too hard to do because of the size of their platform, or if it's a conscious moral decision that they think it's not their job to intervene.
I think that with Facebook, and this is just speculation, but I do think that there's a way in which they have taken a pragmatic approach and then kind of jerry-rigged a moral argument on top of it. At the scale that Facebook operates, it is probably impossible for Facebook to be wholly responsible and vigilant about hate on the platform. You know, they are in more than 100 countries. This is more than 100 languages. Every single kind of local context is different. And hate speech is not something that can be algorithmically determined. It is, you know, in almost every case, it is expressed through context. So there are plenty of kind of, you know, statements that would sound completely benign if they were made in a context of total equality that suddenly become very frightening if you can understand the historic, you know, racist dog whistles, for example, in the U.S., where there's, you know, there's a whole vocabulary of how racism in the U.S. can be expressed without using slurs. The idea that Facebook could do an effective job of being a moderator of all of those different communities is probably just fundamentally unrealistic. It should not be controversial among people that are thinking seriously about free expression that if you only pay attention to not censoring and don't pay any attention to the ways in which those you are choosing not to censor might be using speech to silence others, you are failing to protect the freedom of expression of vulnerable groups, because there are always groups that are subject to harassment campaigns and subject to pressure to be silenced. And Facebook has time and time again just kind of failed to acknowledge that, failed to see that if you have white nationalists on your platform that are doing everything that they can to silence people that say that white nationalism is bad, that you're not creating an environment for free expression. You're actually just letting your platform be hijacked by hate.
And Julia, that sounds like exactly what happened to you, that groups who you spoke up against sought to silence you in the most horrifying way. Are you sometimes tempted to pull back and not write about this?
Yes.
But you haven't done that?
Not yet.
That was Julia Carey Wong. We wanted to do this episode with her because of the amazing piece she wrote about what she has gone through. Do look that up at theguardian.com. Its title is "The Hate Facebook Fosters Destroys Lives. Here's What It Did to Me." And while you're there, do read all of her brilliant reporting on this, stretching back years. We went to Facebook about this episode and a spokesperson said, "We are making progress keeping this activity off our platform. We've banned over 250 white supremacist organisations and removed 4.7 million pieces of content tied to organised hate globally in the first quarter of 2020, over 96% of which we found before someone reported it. This is an increase from 3 months earlier when we removed 1.6 million posts, over 89% of which we found before someone reported it to us. We are committed to keeping hate off our platform." Facebook also said that they remove any content that celebrates, defends, or attempts to justify the Holocaust, or mocks Holocaust victims, or accuses them of lying about the atrocities, or spews hate against Jewish people in any way. They said that they had commissioned an independent human rights impact assessment into the role of their services in Myanmar that had been published in 2018. They said that progress was being made across five key areas, including accountability, improving enforcement of content policies, engagement, trust, and transparency. Before we go, I just wanted to say a huge thanks to all our Today in Focus listeners, and especially anyone who voted for us in the British Podcast Awards. We were absolutely delighted to be in the top five of the listeners' choice category. We were also named Best Current Affairs Podcast by the judges, who gave us gold in that category, as well as two silvers in Best Daily Podcast and Best Interview for the interview with Auschwitz survivors Susan Pollock and Ivor Pearl. Honestly, some of the most inspirational people I have ever spoken to. All of this is down to our amazing team of Today in Focus producers, so a huge shout out to all of them. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Serena Barker-Singh. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.